So I wanted to talk tonight on identity. And as I was sitting up here, I realized the identification that comes from this environment. I'm on a higher platform than everybody, so it sort of elevates me and puts me above other people. So there's a certain amount of identification that just sort of naturally attaches itself to me just from being in this environment in a way. And I was thinking on how, you know, sort of churches in general play off that whole hierarchy of identifications. I remember when I was in Episcopal Church, the bishops had long, beautiful purple robes and the nicest robes. And, you know, then there were the priests, and then there were the acolytes, and then there was the choir, and then the parishioners. Just sort of different levels of identification around, you know, going to church. And I was thinking, at least it's not as prevalent maybe in Buddhist circles. I know if you go up and sit at a Bayagiri with some very senior monks that have been practicing for a long time, they wear very plain robes, the same robes, I believe, as the other monks. I know the novice monks wear different robes, but once you're ordained as a monk, I believe the level of robes, if there is a difference, it's not noticeable to my eye, let's say. Just an immediate perspective on identity that came up to me as I was sitting up here. My friend Chris and I have been, we're 2 weeks into a beginning meditation class now. And I've been doing this for about 4 years, about three times a year. And one of the real joys about doing this for me is it just reminds me again and again on the sincerity of people in their practice. A lot of people that have never sat before come in and they just really put themselves right there into it. And the other thing that really comes up to me a lot is that this desire that we have to be happy, this desire that we have to not be so stressed out, this desire that we have to be free, you know, to not suffer. And it comes from people right in the beginning. I mean, it's very evident in the beginning class. At least it feels that way for me. And it reminds me of my own desire to not be so encumbered in this life, to not have so much tension, to be there to enjoy those moments as they pass through. And it also brings me back to how much I love the Buddhist teachings, how much I love the Dharma. Because at its core, for me anyway, it has these very practical teachings around how to be unencumbered, how to be free, how to not suffer, and very, very practical practices, which can almost be summed up as coming to the realization that we suffer when we find ourselves not wanting something that we do have, not wanting something that is happening for us, not wanting, you know, our immediate experience, so it's a bit of an aversion to it, or a desire for something else to be happening. It's like what is going on isn't good enough. We'd be happier if something else was going on. Very, very, very practical teachings, you know. It's just to look at this and to see how those reactions, the not wanting or the wanting something else, creates this level of suffering, of dissatisfaction, of, you know, of tension, of, you know, of we're encumbered in some way. Another one of the practical teachings that Eugene started touching on last week, or that started working with last week, if people were here for that, are the three characteristics, the three basic characteristics of existence that the Buddha talked about, that the Buddha taught. Characteristics of existence. I've been thinking about that a lot, you know, a characteristic of our existence. And in thinking about that, I was reading some of, you know, things have properties, characteristics. Fire has the property of heat. Understanding this, we know how to work with fire. We know the uses of fire. Water has the characteristic of being wet. You know, understanding that characteristic, we can use water skillfully. So we don't wash our clothes with fire or, you know, cook with water. Well, we do cook with hot water anyway, but you get what I'm getting at here is that, you know, that we understanding the characteristics or the properties that are intimately involved with things, we can use them skillfully. We can use them to our advantage. So the Buddha talked about the characteristics of our existence. You know, these tools, these skills, the understanding of this, the knowledge of this, can maybe be very useful then. He laid out these three characteristics. Anicca, the Pali word anicca, impermanence. That's what Eugene talked about last week. He brought up the topic of impermanence mainly because the room we were normally sitting in, all of a sudden we aren't there anymore. You know, that too has changed. It all changes. I don't think you have to sit for very long to realize that things change and that everything changes. You know, we might think that things are static, that have some sort of permanence, that have some sort of solidity. But when we really get intimately involved with them, we notice things change. Even in working in beginning meditation classes, it's something that becomes a very apparent, even with, the first sit, paying attention to a breath, it comes, it goes. The next breath, not quite the same as the breath before. The second characteristic is, the Pali word is dukkha, something you've probably heard before. Suffering. I've also heard it described as unreliability. It's really tied closely in with the characteristic of impermanence. There's really no place to rest. Nothing provides lasting reliability. And within that, there's a certain amount of suffering that arises. I almost hate to admit it, but I was watching the Super Bowl before, and I sort of wanted to see the Rolling Stones, which I really liked as a kid. They were playing at the halftime. And Jagger's out there singing, "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." I thought, well, you know, that's sort of dukkha. And seeing an old man trying to behave like he was 20 years old and still can sing that song, for me it was a bit of dukkha too, I think. But I don't mean to offend any Rolling Stone fans in here. The third characteristic is the one I really want to talk about tonight. It's anatta. The Pali word is anatta. It's not self. And to me, that really ties into identity. Who do we think we are? Who are we? How do we describe ourselves? The three characteristics were put in more modern terms by a teacher over in Berkeley named Wes Nisker, he's spoken to this group a number of times, I believe. The way he describes the three characteristics are, life is hard, it'll put you through changes, don't take it personally. And I like that in a lot of ways, especially the not self, the not taking it personally. Because that's really where identity comes in a lot. We all take this very personally sometimes. I take everything personally. You know, I take the weather personally sometimes. You know, I take George Bush getting elected president personally even sometimes. You know, it's a habit or just a human tendency maybe even that we have to take our experiences personally, to identify with them in some way or another. The first time I heard a talk on not self, on anatta, was a number of years ago, and it was a talk given by Joseph Goldstein, who's a wonderful teacher from IMS in Massachusetts. And I was pretty new to practice at the time. And I'm sure it was a great talk, but it really, it irritated me greatly. It was like, how dare this person tell me that you know, I'm not here. Or at least that's the way I was hearing it. You know, that there's not some solidity or there's not something substantial about my own sense of self. I was furious, and I went out. We had a walking meditation after the talk, and I went out, and it was nighttime, and I went far away, and I stomped. I stomped on the ground. And when I look back on that now, I think it was a bit of like, I exist. I exist, you know. I exist. It's a very tricky thing to look at, and it can be a very difficult question. In reading about this, I was reading in the Buddha's own response to this about not self. In the Pali Canon, only once was the Buddha ever asked point blank whether or not there was a self, and he refused to answer. He wouldn't answer that. That is the way he responded some things, that he thought, you know, if I give you an answer for this, it won't be helpful. He wouldn't answer. So then later he was asked again, why won't you answer this question about self, not self? And he said that to hold either the belief in self or the belief in not self too tightly is very detrimental to practice. So basically the question should be put aside. Is there self? Is there not self? Don't get too caught up in that. Jack Kornfield tells the story of Ajahn Chah being asked about the self. And he said, you know, if you try to understand it intellectually, your head would probably explode. So the guidance really here is to not really try to figure out, is there a self or is there not a self? But for me, the way I've been looking at it recently anyway, especially, is through this whole thing of what do I identify with? How does my identity arise and how do I hold on to it? And the really interesting part of this practice can be sometimes is how do I suffer around this? How do I suffer around what do I identify with? How does this cause suffering in my life? And this comes back to, you know, I think we can all generally agree we'd like a life where maybe we didn't suffer so much, you know, that we maybe felt a bit more free, a little less tension. How does our sense of our identity, who we think we are, how does that cause suffering in our life, add to the suffering in our life, in maybe ways that we don't really necessarily have to go through? I've been planning on talking on identity for a while, and last week Eugene even mentioned it. He said, you know, Bill will be talking about identity next week, and then he started talking about impermanence. And in this talk on impermanence, he talked about identity. And he was saying, you know, am I this body? Am I this fingernail? Am I my hair? Am I my skin? And I'm thinking, I wanted to talk about that. That's my talk. And then he does an exercise with his daughter. You know, am I your father? Are you my daughter? You know, can you look at me and not see your father and all this? And it was like, that's my talk. And so I'm sitting up here and I'm feeling tension. I'm feeling anger. I'm feeling, you know, I'm like, oh God, I have to think about something else to talk about now. He's giving my talk. And talking about this with some people, I don't really remember who said it, who pointed out to me. It was like suffering of identity, you know. It's right there in front of me. And I didn't even really realize it at the time. My talk. So, who are we? What do we identify with? You know, we can even suffer around identity about a talk I want to give. It comes up so quick. The suffering that comes around identity can really come from this clinging and believing it. You know, the fact that I have to defend it, to protect it, to continue to push it up, to hold it up, to continue to, you know, create this thing that might just be impermanent, temporary, and not really who I am, not really what is true to myself and what is true to my experience in any particular moment for any of us. So we find ourselves defending our possessions, our property, our prestige, our opinions, our words, defending them, protecting them, believing in them, you know, and suffering if they become in question. So again, you might just think for a minute, how do you describe yourself? What do you identify with? If you're putting an ad in Yahoo to look for a friend or a partner or, you know, something, how would you describe yourself? Who are you? It could even come in like a resume. How do we tell somebody who we are? How do we tell ourselves who we are? I think a common thing in our culture is to identify with career, especially, you know, those of us, you know, not so prevalent amongst kids probably, but certainly for adults, we identify with what we do. And it can be, you know, professional careers or housewives or whatever. I've been telling this story about 4 or 5 years ago. I made a movie, and during that period of my life, I was a filmmaker. And there's a certain puffiness of identity that even comes around being a filmmaker in our culture. I find that it's a career that has a certain amount of respect and coolness about it that I certainly adopted to some degree. And I was aware of it sometimes when I was adopting it, and sometimes I probably wasn't so aware of it. I was certainly aware of it when I'd go back to my home state in Kansas. And I went back to my hometown and showed it in Salina, Kansas. And people there were like, oh my God, you're a filmmaker. You know, how cool is that? The year after that, I wasn't making a movie. So I wasn't really a filmmaker, but there still was that residue of identification with that, that desire to still have that, you know, ha 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 bit of, you know, that excitement of that part of that identity to still be present, to still be, you know, apparent. But what was there was, I'm not making a movie. I'm a filmmaker out of work. I'm a failed filmmaker. I'm a filmmaker has been. That didn't feel very good. There was this desire then, okay, now I have to have a next project. I have to be doing something else. I have to be doing something else cool too, because then I can come back into that, you know, that Sundance world or something. All of this suffering that came around just from my own career. And I'm sure we've all have felt it and noticed it in other people. People adopt the identity of what they do and sort of the accoutrements that come with that. You know, doctors will have a little bit of a different personality identity personality than, say, a janitor would or somebody. And a whole sense, whole different levels of self-worth around it, just from what we do. The other thing about what we do is that I think if we all of us look at it, what we do changes. We've all probably had a number of different careers. How do we relate and react when that changes? What kind of suffering comes around that identification? Even if we had the same career over a period of time, I imagine that changes. Sometimes you're at work and you're really getting praised for what you do. That identification feels pretty good then. Sometimes maybe you've done something that hasn't been too skillful and you aren't doing so well at work. That identification probably doesn't feel so good. Another way we identify a lot, I think, is with our body. And Eugene touched on this last week a lot. Are we our body? You know, do we think that this is who we are? I think in many practical ways, there is identification with their body, and there can be a very healthy identification with our body. I've been carried around in this basic form for 52 years. And it served me well. And I need some identification with it to take care of it, to honor it. It serves me very well in my meditation practice. It becomes really a ground for much of my practice. But am I this body? You know, I've read that every cell in our body is new within 7 years. I've been coming to this group about 7 years. So this body I sit here tonight, if this is right, there's not a cell that was here that was in the body when I started coming to this group. So this is a totally new model than what I started with this group with 7 years ago. It's sort of a, you know, just even realizing that can maybe help break some of this identification about the solidity of this body. I was talking to a group the other night about this, and I said, you know, if you think about it, you're born, and, you know, every 7 years you get to trade up a model. And, you know, for the first 4 or 5 trade-ups, you get good trade-ups. You get faster, leaner, more intelligent, more capable, more agile, you know. And then you start trading down. And then you keep trading down and down, you know, and you don't get a choice over this. And I was thinking, you know, if you're lucky enough to continue to trade down for a while, there's a likelihood that all of us will trade down into a body that, you know, that won't even leave the lot after a while. Can we be here for this changing nature of body? Or do we try to say, this is my body, this is who I am, and then do we suffer as it changes, as it does its thing, that we don't have much control over? I would prefer not to be trading down all the time now. I think we can also identify a lot with our emotions. People often describe themselves, I've heard people describe themselves, as I'm a happy person. I'm a fearful person. I'm a nervous person. You know, even I know the 7 archetypes of the Enneagram. There is some truth to this identity. We do have archetypes that we are more predominant with. But is it really who we are? Does it serve us to say we are this and sort of start to close ourselves off to solidify ourselves around something that maybe is limited, that isn't the true full picture of what our identity really is? When you think about the range of emotions that all of us have gone through, it's really incredible. The Buddha called them the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. I've even seen Western psychology manuals that list the range of emotions we all go through, and there's hundreds of them. It's an amazing chart. And when you read it, you can sort of read through this and yeah, I felt this, I felt this, I felt this, I felt this, I felt this. And yet, I think sometimes we can identify around a certain few and say, okay, this is really who we are. And it's like, but you felt all these other ones too. It really is starting to make something that's small and more solid and more concrete in a field that is really vast and wondrous and amazing and that we all know. We all know the range. So just another thing to pay attention to. How do we limit ourselves and how do we add unnecessary suffering around who we think we are as if in our emotions? We also identify around relationship and relationships. Family relationships, love relationships, friendship relationships. These two, I don't think, are very static. There's nothing very solid or reliable about even something that is true. I am my mother's son. She's my mom. And yet, the nature of our relationship has changed and continues to change all the time. Who's helping who? And it bounces back and forth. It's not a static relationship. And yet, sometimes that identity, right, I'm your son, can close off a whole bunch of other things. Sometimes I'm her friend. Sometimes I want to get away from her. You know, it's not small. It's not defined. In thinking about this, and thinking about how I hold my relationship sometimes, it's a disservice to the relationship to hold it as a static, fixed idea, identity. What a gift it is to give a friend or a loved one the opportunity to be who they are in that moment as it moves on, as it continues to change, in relationship to me and to us, you know. It's wonderful to let those we love maybe be depressed or anxious or distant even sometimes, because we all go through this. Our own reaction, our own mood fluctuates. So how can we be in a static, solid relationship with another around that? And yet, we tend to identify with that. And we get angry and stressed out and suffer when that does change sometimes. How dare you be in a bad mood? How dare you be distant from me? It happens. You know, the identities we have, there's so many of them, you know, you could talk for weeks almost. We often think we're our things. There's some identification with our things. Our cars, our homes, our clothes, our houses, our iPods, our computers. And I think of all the stress I've had when, like, my computer's broken. I dropped a glass of water on my laptop this week, and it was like, oh, my computer's not going to work. You know, then I can reflect back on all the different possessions I've had that they're all gone, you know, 90% of them or 95 or 98% of them are gone now. But all the suffering I had when something happened to them while I had them, while I had a strong identity with them, my scratches on my cars, you know, bleach spots on my clothes, broken computers, cracked dishes, you know, whatever it is. My dishes are cracked. I hurt, you know. All this identity we have with our things, and yet so many of our things are all gone. So, you know, are they our things, I guess, is really sort of the question. Or do we have them for a while? That seems to be more of the real nature of what is going on, it seems to me. Boy, one way we can identify, I mean, I imagine a lot of us here can identify with being a Buddhist, with being a spiritual person. There can be all sorts of baggage with that. I'm a good meditator. I had a good meditation, you know. I had a bad meditation. Just to notice that identity and the suffering that can come around that. I've done a lot of retreat practice, a pretty fair amount of retreat practice. And even then, as soon as I said that, there's some identity that came up around that. And then I just realized, oh my God, there are people that have done a ton of retreat practice, you know. There's all of a sudden this comparison that immediately popped up for me. So, going back to it, I've done a fair amount of retreat practice. And it's always amazing to me the identity that can come around that sometimes. The competitiveness, the comparison with somebody else. Oh my God, they sat through the whole morning and didn't move. They look so peaceful. I could only sit through two sets and be really peaceful. I'm an okay meditator. I'm not a great meditator. My identity was called into question around that. Or this person over there, they're fidgeting all the time. Oh, I'm a good meditator. They aren't so good. You know, it's just the identity that can come around paying attention. what's beautiful about this practice is that we get to sit and pay attention to that, you know, to that, the arising of identity around that. What I'd like to say about these identities and the many others that you might realize come up is that a beautiful thing is just to notice them. To notice them when they arise and to notice the suffering that can come up around that. Are they really who we are? Or is it an idea, a concept, a limitation? Can there be some space around that? And can there even be some kindness around that? Oh yeah, there's that identity rising again. There's that I, me, mine that's coming into play again. The more solidly we grasp on these, on our identities, the more problems we create for ourselves. Jack Kornfield quotes a Sri Lankan meditation master who put it really very simply. He said, "No self, no problem." Really, if I could go on those retreats and just sit there and just be with my experience and not have to compare myself or wanting this desire to identify as a good meditator, no problem, no problem. I think it's important not to think we need to abandon identities. Identities are very useful. They can come in very handy. If we identify with our career, it can be very useful if we're applying for a job, if we're doing a job, you know. But how do we hold that? How tightly do we really hold on to that? I think some identity can be very important too, because I think a lot of us in this culture can feel very disenfranchised. We need to have something to identify with, something that makes us feel safe and in community, in Sangha. I've said this up here before, but I grew up a gay kid in Kansas, and I didn't have a very good self-esteem around that, especially back in the 60s. There wasn't much that supported that, and there was a lot that didn't support that. And so I didn't have an identity around that. I wanted an identity around that. And I think San Francisco became a haven for people to come here and identify as sort of who they are sexually. And that became very important for a lot of people. And now in the gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender world, there are a lot of identity cultures that have developed within that. And I think in many ways those can be very helpful. You can find like-minded people. You can find people that you feel safe with, that you can hang out with, that really make you feel at home. I think this is part of what goes on here even. A lot of us have very similar values. This is a place where we can come and share that with other people. We can be supported by that with other people. So our identity around being a Buddhist, around wanting to follow these teachings, can be very helpful, very skillful, very supportive. Create Sangha. The trick is how solid do we make this? How finite. I've been coming to this group for 7 years now, and there's very few people here that started coming 7 years ago. A lot of the people that were here then don't come anymore, and there's a lot of new people here, and it's really beautiful. But it's a very alive, changing, moving entity, group, Sangha. If I wanted the Sangha that was here 7 years ago, I would be suffering. I have to be open to the aliveness of it, the motion of it. So, to realize these identities can be very helpful, but to not just say, okay, this is it, you know. This is who I am. This is how it's going to be. I'd like to switch gears here a little bit for a second and read a poem. And read a poem about, it's a poem by Thich Nhat Hanh, and it's called Call Me By My True Names. And to me, this, I'm sure many of you have heard this before, but it's a beautiful poem, and I hope you don't mind hearing it again. Because for me, this talks a lot about identity. Who do we think we are? Or also, how vast are we? How incredibly and unknowingly vast and wide and expansive and inclusive are all of us. So this is by Thich Nhat Hanh. For those of you who don't know, he's a Buddhist meditation master teacher from Vietnam who was a peace activist in Vietnam during the 60s, during the war, and had to leave, and actually just went back to Vietnam for the first time last January. And one of our Sangha members here, Kim, went and sat with him in Vietnam, I believe, last February when he was teaching back in his country. Wonderful teacher and a very, very practical teacher. This is his poem, Call Me By My True Names. Before I read the poem, I'd like to read you his paragraph about describing this poem. I have a poem for you. This poem is about three of us. The first is a 12-year-old girl, one of the boat people crossing the Gulf of Siam. She was raped by a sea pirate, and after that she threw herself into the sea. The second person is the sea pirate, who was born in a remote village in Thailand. And the third person is me. I was very angry, of course, but I could not take sides against the sea pirate. If I could have, it would have been a lot easier, but I couldn't. I realized that if I had been born in his village and had lived a similar life, economic, educational, and so on, it is likely that I would now be the sea pirate. So it is not easy to take sides. Out of suffering, I wrote this poem. It is called, Please Call Me By My True Names, because I have many names. And when you call me by any of them, I have to say yes. In the poem. Don't say that I depart tomorrow. Even today I am still arriving. Look deeply. Every second I am arriving. I am arriving to be a bud on a spring branch. To be a tiny bird with still fragile wings, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, to fear and to hope. The rhythm in my heart is the birth and death of all that is alive. I am the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird that swoops down to swallow the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond, and I am the grass snake that silently feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hands. And I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a force-fed labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom all over the earth. My pain is like a river of tears, so vast it fills the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all my cries and my laughter at once, so I can see that my joy and pain are one. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up, so the door of my heart can be left open. The door of compassion. That poem really speaks of a limitless sense of identity, which I think we all can relate to it in some way. I'd like to read another. I was at a yoga class a couple of months ago, and the teacher before yoga read this quote from Ram Dass that really touched me. So I wrote the teacher, and I had him send me this quote. And it says, "You spend the first half of your life becoming somebody. Now you can work on becoming nobody, which is really somebody. For when you become nobody, there is no tension, no pretense, no one trying to be anyone or anything. The natural state of the mind shines through, unobstructed. The natural state of the mind is pure love." I like this when he says, when you become nobody, there is no tension, no pretense, no one trying to be anyone or anything. Boy, that really speaks about what I started with tonight about, we all want to be happy. We all want this sort of sense of freedom. No tension, no pretense. Not trying to be somebody, not identifying. So we all have this practice we do here together, this meditation practice, this practice of sitting still and paying attention. One of the goals of this practice is to gain insight, to see clearly, to gain some sort of wisdom. Part of this really takes us back to who are we? What is our true self? What is, our identity? As Ram Dass said, the natural state of the mind shines through. So we have this practice that we share of insight, of meditation, of looking. I think this practice is a wonderful tool to really sort of help us look at our identities, to see our identities, and to start to weaken our grasping and our clinging and our belief in them. Not to annihilate them, but just to start to weaken them so that we aren't so attached. We realize that our identities aren't really who we are. Even in a small degree, it can start to loosen these identifications, this practice that we do. Getting back, it aligns us with that characteristic, the characteristics of existence. Just as heat and fire are they have this integration with them. Can our understanding of not self, of how we identify, really serve us? Can we use it skillfully? Also, as we practice, we come across our identities and the results of them, a contracted body, a body of fear. So we can start to learn, maybe I can loosen up around this. Maybe I can sit with this. Again, maybe these bonds loosen up a little bit. We learn to sit with maybe a calmer heart. We learn to listen as opposed to react. All things that can maybe, again, loosen up our sense of identity. Another thing that can happen with practice, and I hope you've all have experienced this, is that we realize what our true nature is. I just remember being on retreat and just realizing, even from a sit even, the heart opens. And when the heart opens, the love just is there. Love just comes out. And all these other qualities start to show themselves. Compassion, joy, generosity, equanimity. They can arise with a sit. We're fortunate right now that we have our teacher Eugene and our volunteer coordinator, one of our senior practitioners, Stefano. They're up on a month-long retreat right now. They're on day two. They just finished their first full day. They just finished their second full day. And what you experience, or what's often experienced on long retreat, are these natural states just arise. Open-heartedness, compassion, you know, love. Maybe this is our identity, you know, maybe this is sort of who we are. But this, there again, as the Buddha would certainly say, don't take my word for it. Experience it for yourself and look, you know, notice how you feel after the end of a sit sometimes. Not to expect it, not to be irritated if it's not there, but is there a more general sense of an open heart, of a calm body and mind, of a less reactive person, of somebody that maybe doesn't cling and identify and own as I, me, or mine something maybe quite as quickly? This lack of, or this wanting to sort of really look at identity and look at it carefully and look at the suffering that it causes, I want to come back one more time again to say, you know, it's not that we should lose all identity. As I talked about, you know, the identity of Sangha, or the myriad identities we have. I am my mother's son. I am in relationship. We all have thousands of identities that really serve us. But these are identities that are really moment to moment and that are always changing. And to really maybe start to come into some sort of alignment with that. But we also have our individuality. It's beautiful. I mean, thank God. If everybody in the world was like me, I'd be bored to tears. And our individuality is to be honored and respected. And to not to have any sort of expectation around that we have to let that go too, or that we don't have predominant things that we do identify with sometimes, ways of being, ways of reacting. But keeping that in mind, I'd like to close with a quote from Jack Kornfield from his book, Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. He says, "While we cannot know our karmic past, we can recognize the deep patterns and archetypes that make up our individuality. Then these unique patterns and character types we discover can be honored and transformed, in practice from rigid identifications to transparent jewels." I love that. We can be our individuality, our identifications can be transformed in practice from rigid identifications to transparent jewels. This allows the qualities of enlightenment to shine through our own particular expression. So it is my sincere wish that some of these words can maybe lead to a little less suffering around any sort of identification manifestations that might arise for any of us. Even just a moment of freedom from that can be a beautiful thing.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.